Hello and welcome to the CISS podcast. This is the On the Spot series by China Forum. In this series, we return to the platform of international forums and webinars where leading minds in academia, government, business, technology, and media deliver novel, collaborative responses to the global issues of the day.
Hello and welcome to CISS podcast On the Spot series. This is Bei Bei with China Forum. With ongoing regional wars and conflicts, and 2024 being a super election year, the world seems to be experiencing even more volatility and uncertainty. Yet, we can also see some bright sides as the global South, including China, have been more active in making endeavors to generate peace and stability. What does a changing world mean to China, especially concerning its relationships with the US, Europe, and also neighboring countries such as India? To what extent can China's high standard opening up national policy and its global trade relations help to integrate a more fragmented world? With these questions in mind, I spoke with Mr. Zhou Bo on the sidelines of the 6th International Forum on Security and Strategy, organized by CISS, Tsinghua University. Mr. Zhou Bo is a China Forum expert and senior fellow of CISS Tsinghua University. He also has decades of experience serving in China's military. Here is my conversation with Mr. Zhou Bo.
We're very happy to have you join us for our podcast interview. So on March 11th, the two sessions concluded, and high standard opening up is one of the keywords. So what do you think China's opening up national policy means for China and the rest of the world in face of so much uncertainty?
Simply put, China has demonstrated that it will continue to open even wider to the world. Because if we look at what happened in the past 40 years and plus, we clearly can tell that China's progress is how China actually has become integrated with the global system, with the international system, and how China has actually learned from the West in terms of a market economy, in terms of high tech, in terms of higher education, so on and so forth. So this is one of the largest miracles in human history, that so far we have achieved so much within such a short span of time, including eliminating the poverty of 800 million people. So I think at the two sessions, we have actually demonstrated a new commitment to have even wider, deeper reform. And this is good news for the world. And I believe that all the countries that we have announced to provide a one-way visa-free system in years to come would be highly welcome. And I believe this will continue because actually we have made two announcements, right? So it is one announcement built upon another. Yeah. So it's not just a one single announcement.
Right.
So that demonstrates that this kind of enlargement of our engagement with the rest of the world will simply deepen.
So China's message is very clear to the rest of the world. We are more open and we'll keep to do so. And I remember our foreign minister, Wang Yi, said China will continue to be a stabilizing force in major power relations, and on top of that, be more open. The next question concerns Russia. Recently, Vladimir Putin successfully won his fifth election with a record high percentage of votes and began his new six-year term. What do you think Putin's re-election means for China-Russian relations?
First of all, President Putin's re-election is a decision made by the Russian people, right? And we understand how important it is for Russia to have a strong leader. So that probably tells why he's elected, especially at a time when Russia actually is being involved in a war with a neighboring country. I was also asked about this question, actually some kind of suspicion regarding China-Russian relationship at this time. And this kind of questions, made mainly from West, it is understandable in that because China is becoming so important, therefore China's attitude would matter tremendously. And this would have a huge repercussion, especially in European capitals. Yeah, and I always tell them, when you look at the China-Russian relationship, you cannot examine this relationship through the prism of Europe. because we are largest neighbors to each other.
Right.
First of all, we have to look at this relationship on a bilateral basis.
Exactly.
And because of a historic relationship, which is a bit up and down from time to time,
right.
Therefore we have to be more careful about this relationship.
Mm.
And apparently a stable, strong Russia is in our interest, mm. and vice versa. So that is why we have seen so many exchange of visits on a regular basis. People talk about why President Putin would come to China again, because this kind of agreement was made in 1990. Yeah,
mm.
This kind of high-level exchanges must be maintained on an annual basis. So you would see President Putin came to visit China and President Xi would go to Moscow to visit Russia. So this kind of exchange of visits are already institutionalized, yeah?
Mm.
So I think we don't know how the war will last, right? There are so many uncertainties. If I compare those two wars, one in Ukraine and another in the Middle East, then my conclusion is we don't know when the war in Ukraine will end. And we don't know when the war, even if stopped for a while, would crop up again in the Middle East, right? And that is the difference. But a low war will last forever. And China has put forward a 12-point peace plan for the war in Ukraine. The question is how practical it is, right? People ask me about this question because it seems that this proposal have more general ideas than specific steps of in a roadmap.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, right now, I do not see either Kiev or Moscow or even Washington wants to have a ceasefire.
Mm-hmm.
So the Chinese plan can only work but people have a genuine wish to have a ceasefire, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, however, demonstrates our strong commitment to have a peaceful and stable Europe, which certainly serves China's best interest, especially at a time
mm-hmm.
when the so-called China-US competition mm-hmm. is rising ever higher.
And you mentioned when we were talking about China-Russia relations that there's suspicion from the West. Can you elaborate a little bit? What kind of suspicion?
Yeah, I think the problem from the West is that they are placing a hope which is too high on China. You see, everybody now understands how important China is. And therefore, as a result, people either are afraid of you or they are worried about you or sometimes they have too much hope on you.
Hmm.
And because of the fact that this war actually has occurred in the heartland of Europe, so the European countries are naturally worried. I was in Berlin, and I remember vividly how some academics told me that the distance between Berlin and Kiev is just like from Beijing to Shanghai, plus 200 kilometers. So if there is a nuclear war in Kiev, how it will matter to Germans? So I totally understand this question. Right. So they just want you sweet talk or even add pressure on Russia.
I see.
Yeah, just to stop it. And they believe China has such kind of authority to ask Russia to stop immediately. No, we don't.
No. And of course, it takes two sides
to
stop the fighting.
Yeah.
Not just one side.
Mm.
Do you see an end to the conflict in Ukraine anywhere in sight?
The fact is, no war will last forever, right? So the only question is how eventually things may come down. So many different possibilities. But I believe, and this is what most people talk about, is a kind of armistice.
Okay.
Armistice is a kind of institutionalized ceasefire. The first, if people are tired of fighting with one another, then there is a ceasefire. But armistice is still kind of a warring situation, but people have decided to stop fighting mm-hmm. without signing officially a peace agreement.
Without a timeline.
Yeah, so this kind of situation would look very much like the one we already have in Korean Peninsula. But this one, I assume, would actually be more volatile because in Korean Peninsula, the strengths between the two sides are more or less balanced over years. But in this situation, with Russia being so strong, Kiev supported wholly by Washington and NATO. So it's difficult to argue which side is stronger. So that is why I would argue that the outcome is very much like an armistice. But I truly believe that it is Washington that is standing behind Kiev is actually holding the key to resolve the problem. I don't believe this actually is a solution between Kiev and Moscow. Even all the Western countries say, okay, it's up to the Ukrainian to decide. No, I don't think so.
Mm.
Without kind of all-out support from the West, if simplicity cannot continue.
Mm.
Yeah, it's just as simple as that.
Right.
Yeah.
Both in manpower and also
that's right.
So regarding China's focus on the peaceful resolutions of the crisis in Ukraine and also the conflict in Gaza, we know that on March 2nd and 7th, Li Hui, special representative of Chinese government on Eurasia affairs, arrived in Moscow and Kiev, respectively, to continue the second round of the shuttle diplomacy, promoting a political settlement to the Ukraine crisis. And then on the 13th and 14th of March, Chinese diplomat Wang Kejian visited Palestine and Israel. So what constructive role do you think China will continue to play in both the Ukraine crisis and the conflict in Gaza?
I think all these visits are certainly helpful, but they are not silver bullets or panaceas that can
fix everything.
Yeah, that can resolve the problem immediately. Mm-hmm. Because there is something similar in the Middle East and in Ukraine. That is, some people simply do not want to stop at this moment, right?
The people who are involved
They do not want to stop. So if they do not want to stop, how can you ask them to stop? They are warring parties, right? But I think it is clear that China has a huge interest in a peaceful Europe and in a peaceful Middle East. Why is that? Because China has huge interest everywhere now, especially in the economic field. And in the Middle East, the people would traditionally think, okay, this is where the Chinese oil would come from. It is true, but it goes much beyond that. Yeah. Exactly. Once I was in Dubai and I talked to a local Chinese who was involved in building materials for housing, so on and so forth, asked him, how large is the Chinese material for this market? He saw it for a moment and then he said 100%.
All from China?
Yeah. I remember that because this is almost impossible for me. If you say, okay, we have 80%, 85%, that is understood. At that time in Dubai, there are 200,000 people. But now people say we have 400,000 people working there.
From China?
Yeah, from China, in Dubai alone. So China's interests are now so diversified in almost every field. So of course it is our interest to see peace and stability in these two regions. And of course, given the fact that China has successfully mediated between Saudis and the Iranians, that is a good example of how China has been successful in making its own contribution. But you cannot say that China can actually of his own success every time and everywhere, right?
The situation is different.
Yeah.
And I think the world is not as aware of the impact of the Ukraine war has on China's economy, the disruption in supply chains and also in trade. And maybe that contributed to the world not taking China's peaceful resolution as sincerely. It's in our interest. It's in different parties' interest to have a peaceful resolution. And a word on the United States. I think the world has been standing on tiptoe watching the 2024 presidential election. And so far, President Biden and Donald Trump have both secured their party's nomination. How do you think this process and results of the U.S. election will affect the development in the Asian Pacific region? So in the two cases, what do you think will happen?
I think it's a good question asked by almost everybody now, right?
Mm-hmm.
First of all, if President Biden continues to be American president, we could see a continuity in his policy, that is for sure. But whether it's good or not, I'm not so confident because I believe actually these two people have been learning from each other and their policy as a result would not be very much different. Why is that? I actually recently have published an opinion in South China Morning Post in which I argued Trump, you know, 2.0, actually would be very much like President Biden.
Why is
that? Because, first of all, Trump described himself as a deal maker. He's not an ideologist.
Right.
But the irony is what he has led in his first term was something very much ideological. That is a bipartisan consensus against China. Joe Biden in the past was friendly to China. And some people even call him Beijing's Joe. But then, how was he toward China? He simply continues policy towards China in the name of de-risking. Trump's policy was decoupling. Decoupling certainly has failed. So they actually have borrowed a term coined by von der Leyen to describe it as de-risking. But the question is, What is the difference between decoupling and de-risking? I believe they themselves even won't tell. Yeah, clearly, right? Mm. So Biden's policy is already a follow-up of Trump's policy. Then if Trump is elected, why do I say that his policy would be very much like that of Biden? Why? Because he would look at the lessons learned in the past. Apparently, decoupling is impossible. Mm-hmm. And he threatens to increase the tariff to 60%, which, according to Bloomberg, would mean zero in bilateral trade, basically zero. And then you can imagine American companies in China would suffer from a hit, and the American customers would complain, right? So it serves nobody's interest. And that actually is his strategy.
So you think he's bluffing?
Yeah, because he made it clear in his autobiography, I always aim high and then go after my aim a little bit higher each time. Yeah, that is his strategy. He described it. But on China, clearly decoupling has failed. Then what can he actually do on China? Biden's policy is just okay, small yada high fence. So I believe Trump this time will continue Biden's policy to restrict this kind of a technical flow to China. So this is what can do. Then there are some other things. I basically believe whoever comes as the next American president, he has a fewer cards in his hand against China. Why? Because the international situation has changed. A few things that are obvious. First, the rise of the West against the West.
I see.
Second, the clear shift of international geopolitical and geoeconomic gravity towards this region. And nobody can change that. So that means Global South is becoming more important. And that means China actually stands in the center on the stage. But remember one thing, if China stands in the center, doesn't mean that there is only one China standing in the center. China is surrounded by other countries like India, like Indonesia, like ASEAN countries. So these things won't change. And then something has changed. What is that? That is Americans' double standard that is clearly recognized by all people around the world, even in Western countries, because of its different attitudes towards the two worlds at the same time. So this would be a heavy blow to Americans' moral authority and Americans' influence. For example, we are professionals, so I often talk about freedom of navigation, UN Convention on Law of the Sea. So when it comes to this kind of American double standard of signing UNCLOS but not ratifying UNCLOS, very few people know. But on this kind of two wars, everybody knows. So this would be a heavy blow to America's moral authority. So I would argue that, in fact, the U.S. would have few cards. You see, who will then listen to all this kind of nonsense like democracy versus autocracy?
So people can see the reality.
Yeah, right now, no countries are stupid to take sides. And all of them are clever in taking sides on issues. On this issue, I'm with you. On that issue, I'm with him.
To balance.
So, to balance. And so you don't know which side I'm really taking, you see? So no countries are foolish. And this is how the world looks right now. So the world certainly is becoming more fragmented. That's true. The question is, nobody knows what to do. And right at this conference, and I'm hearing time and again, that we can only aim at having corporations on small things first. Do not aim too high, right?
So to summarize a little bit, so in your opinion, the policies of Biden administration and Trump administration won't be as divergent as a lot of people imagine.
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I think that they would become somewhat similar.
They grow on each other in a way.
You see, what President Trump would like to play with is his unpredictability, right? He used that as a weapon. And he talked about how he used that as a weapon. But for China, China has experience of dealing with either Trump and Biden. So if we, as we talked in the beginning, keeps on reforming, keeps on opening the door wider.
And doing to keep, what we should do.
Yeah, to keep China deeply integrated in the international system, what should we really be afraid of?
Right. And also you mentioned the U.S. will have fewer cards in the future against China. That sounds like a good thing. But then sometimes when people have fewer cards, they have crazy moves.
Ah, yeah.
They go to the extreme.
Yes.
Is that a possibility?
Yeah, that certainly is possible.
And now, when they run out of options.
Yeah, exactly. By the question, for example, in Taiwan, in the South China Sea. And there are two different issues, but I always argue, and the Secretary has raised the considerable international attention, that is, South China Sea actually is far more dangerous than Taiwan Strait. Why is that? Because in the South China Sea, we would see other countries provoking China. For example, the U.S. would keep on sending aircraft and ships for closing reconnaissance and surveillance, and they would, in the South China Sea, chanting freedom of navigation. And sometimes the ships are getting too close to each other, mm-hmm. and the aircraft are getting too close to each other. So that is why it is dangerous. Americans, Pentagon report says that in the last couple of years, we in PLA made 180 interceptions. But that, for me, tells how frequently...
You come over
yeah,
here.
Yeah, you have come, right? That means every 4 days, we would make one interception. And then my question is, okay, where did all this interception happen?
Who's complaining
yeah,
here?
Yeah, it is near us, right?
Right.
So the answer is very simple. If you do not come, or if you promise that you to reduce this kind of frequency, of course, it is becoming less dangerous. But I believe the United States, in this regard, is just like someone who has climbed up too high in the tree. Mm. That's difficult for him to climb down.
Yeah. And just one more question regarding the U.S. foreign policy. Since it's still involved in the Ukraine war and also getting more involved in the Middle East, do you think it still has the energy to focus on South China Sea, or is it pivoting towards?
Very good question. First of all, I believe these two wars, which nobody knows how long will last, will certainly distract American attention from China. This is what they don't want to see, but this is what is happening. The two war at the same time will definitely distract their attention. And then the other thing is, Americans' whole strength actually has declined tremendously. And they don't like to hear such kind of things. If you say America has declined, they're very much unhappy. Mm-hmm. If you say you have a relative decline, they have to admit, because by the end of the Second World War, their GDP is half of the world. Exactly. Right now, it is a quarter of the world. Of course, they have declined. And that is precisely why President Biden has been talking about the importance of allies. Mm. Trump's policy could be described as American first. But according to Richard Haass, the former president of the Council of Foreign Relations, Biden's policy is allies first. It's very much like that. But why allies first? Yeah. Because American strength is not strong enough anymore. Mm. So they need desperately the help and assistance of allies. Mm-hmm. So you keep on hearing this kind of talks on important matter, because even to focus on China in the Indo-Pacific, they need allies. But the question is then, is how important are these allies? They're helpful in some ways, like AUKUS clearly is a military organization which is growing with strength. Mm-hmm. The question is how strong it can become. That remains to be seen.
Last question regarding India. So India will hold its general election this year, and it's widely expected that Prime Minister Modi will succeed in winning a third term. Mm-hmm. As a major regional power in Asia, what role do you think India will play in the region and in the world?
First of all, India's future is bright, almost like China's future, which is also bright. That is because India's economy is growing fast, and India's population is big, but young. Yeah?
But young.
Okay. Yeah. So therefore, some people would doubt about China's economic future, because they saw some kind of uncertainty, which I don't believe are justifiable. But very few people doubt about India's economic future. So in my argument, I would say that the so-called Asian century has actually already dawned because of the growth of China and India, for example. Then that would invite a question. How can these two Asian giants coexist in amity with one another? Mm. Unfortunately, the situation is not very much sanguine now because of what happened in Galvan Valley. Yeah, this is the most unfortunate, but still, I see something positive. All the confidence building measures in the last 4 decades actually have worked to a great extent. Mm. Both sides realize that in any circumstances, we should not fight at each other.
they don't want to escalate.
Yeah, I think they are subconscious that they should not shoot at each other. Mm. And this is very, very important. Mm. So with this...
It's subtle, but important.
Yeah. So with this lesson, sometimes I think, yeah, this has costed our bilateral relationship tremendously, especially on Indian psyche. Mm. But then, what about the next 40 years? If we can really draw some good lesson learned from this small, unpleasant incident, that never again should this kind of things happen again. So probably we can have more confidence in our future in the next 40 years to make sure that it won't happen again. So this is possible.
Wouldn't it be in India's interest, as in China's interest, to maintain good neighborly relationships? Is there any reason for India to make any trouble or to provoke China in any way?
That's a good question, because that has a lot of things to do with the border areas, which unfortunately are not demarcated. That means, theoretically speaking and practically speaking, neither side knows exactly where the border is. Mm-hmm. And why is that? Because, this is something that is most ironic. I know this only too well because I have worked on South Asia for 10 years as staff officer, and I'm even a negotiator over the border issue. Yes. The point is, we don't even agree on the length of the border. That is most funny, right? China believes the border is just 2,000 kilometers, while India would believe it is 3,488 kilometers.
Exact.
So you can imagine
it's
that.
More complicated.
Even if we can resolve this 2,000 kilometer border issue, India believes there is still a big chunk of land that cannot be resolved. Okay, let's then talk about this 2,000 kilometers first. Chinese approach and Indian approach are totally different. China would say, okay, how about we have a political consensus? Let's swap land, basically. That is called the mutual understanding and a mutual accommodation. Mm-hmm. This is a general idea. We have never talked about which part
specific
of
area.
Yeah, specific area to be swapped. But this is basically Chinese thinking. To have some kind of a political consensus.
Right.
Yeah, let's make some mutual accommodation first.
Being creative.
But the Indians won't think like that. The Indians say, okay, why do we have so many standoffs and so many problems? That is because the borderline is not clear. So we should make clear where the border actually lies. For us to do that, let's make a consensus to demarcate the borderline, to know at least where it lies. Then in this regard, I won't step into your territory out of mistake, but then there is a kind of danger. The thing is, if we do in an Indian way without having a political consensus in the beginning, then maybe India would say, okay, since we have verified and neither of us can make a concession, we have to live with this verifying line, which is not a border. Mm-hmm. So there is a kind of political risk, and we can hardly come to agree on these two different approaches. Chinese is kind of a top-bottom, mm-hmm. and Indian is bottom-up.
They're
totally in two different directions. But then, about the border issue, the important thing is, I believe Chinese position over years has been far more consistent. Because Rajiv Gandhi visited China in the 1980s. And before that means after the war and before Rajiv Gandhi's visit, India's position is always that we have to resolve this border issue before we make efforts to improve our relationship.
I see.
So it's always like that. And now, after this most unpleasant incident, Indian government's position is almost like that before the 1980s. We must return to the status quo in April 2020. Otherwise, it's difficult for us to talk about cooperation in other areas, something like that.
Hmm.
From time to time, you would hear Indians talking about that.
Stuck at the same point.
Yeah, but then I have a very easy question for them. Other countries that have territorial issues with India, because China is not the only country that have territorial issues with India,
mm-hmm.
then ask in a similar way, how would India respond? If you just read Wikipedia, you would find a long list of territories unresolved. Because this is part of human history.
We'll be spending the next century
resolving
territorial issues.
It's just impossible to resolve all these issues. So this is just like we have to live with some problem, with some illness, with some disease, but still we're okay.
So you're suggesting to find some way to go beyond this point where we're stuck and solve other problems.
We put it in one basket, but this is not the whole of a bilateral relationship.
Exactly.
And the interesting thing is that right now we have another force that is stronger than the argument of the Indian government official. That is the force of the market. Because after this incident, still the bilateral trade went up. So you can imagine after this how unpleasant these Indian people are. So actually Chinese companies suffer a lot in India. But still bilateral trade went up. That means there are some other things that are developing more or less in a more healthy way. So that means this kind of policy doesn't really work. We can talk about that, but this is not the whole thing between our two great countries. And right now, both of us are becoming so important. We should not be hijacked by the border.
So hopefully we'll see more flexibility in international relations, especially on Indian's part. And also we are betting on the magic that the market can play, not just between China and India, but globally.
Yeah, right now we are not seeing this. I think they are still engulfed in the quoted sad mood, So we haven't seen much improvement in bilateral relationship.
Well, I hope that, other countries can share more of China's opening up mentality. And I think that will smooth things out because there'll be more dialogue and communication.
Theoretically, of course, this is right, but it will take some time, right? But no war will last forever and no wounds, cannot be healed.
Yes.
So this matter.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you
so much for your expertise and your time for our interview.
That was my conversation with Mr. Zhou Bo, China Forum expert and senior fellow of CISS, Tsinghua University. Thank you for listening, and please stay tuned to our future episodes in this series. See you next time.